We're just waiting for a few more people to come in, and so we're ready. We'll be ready for our first discussion session for today. And so, what I'd like to do with this discussion session. So normally, what we do is we give some questions or something like that to discuss. But what I'd like to do for this time, a little bit different, again because we're trying to focus much more intently on the suttas for this workshop, is. By the way, is everyone? Do we need the aircon on? Is everyone comfortable with aircon? We do need aircon? No, we don't need aircon. No, we're good? Okay, that's fine. So what I'd like to do for this session is we'll put up one sutta. So this is one of the shorter and more simple suttas from the reading. And so we'll give this as the topic for discussion. And so we'll, as usual, break up into groups, and then the topic will simply be to discuss this sutta. If you're happy to sort of just get going with that, then just get going. Otherwise, maybe somebody in the group can be the person to read the sutta. So you can maybe read a passage or a paragraph or something from the sutta, and then sort of discuss each one, ask questions about it, and so on and so forth. So this is one of the more simple suttas, but it deals with the fundamental principles of karma, so it should hopefully raise up some of those questions. So the basic main teaching here is the three causes for the origination of karma. What three? Greed is a cause for the origination of karma. Hatred is a cause for the origination of karma. Delusion is a cause for the origination of karma. Any karma fashioned through greed ripens where that individual is reborn. Wherever that karma ripens, it is there that one experiences its result, either in this life or in the next rebirth or on some subsequent occasion. So this is the idea that you have these three basic causes I mentioned before, the dasa kusala kammapata. Actually, we can analyze these 10 ways of wholesome or unwholesome action in terms of greed, hatred, and delusion. So these are the basic motivations for causing this kind of karma, which can ripen in this life, in the next rebirth, or on some subsequent occasion. Okay? So this is the text. And let's break up into groups and have some discussion. Back for the second part, major session. And as I mentioned before, my plan was that because the reading list is very extensive, and I managed to look at a little bit of the teaching before the lunch, and we managed to discuss another sutta, but of course there are many, many other suttas in that reading list, and we can't hope to discuss them all. So what I'd like, ideally, is if you have any questions, any particular suttas that you thought were very interesting or passages that you felt you didn't understand that you want to ask questions about and so on. So if you can give me those hints and we can use that to begin. If not, I can go through some of the other suttas. But we'll, I'd just like to begin by just asking, is there any of those suttas that anybody would really like to hear about some more?
The one we're about to do now, Bandhavi.
Which one, sorry?
Gupta
3.69.
Okay.
The roots of bad choices.
Okay.
If that's agreeable.
And why that one, particularly?
Well, that's a huge impact to our life.
Okay. Okay. Okay, fair enough. But I mean, that's a fair enough point, but that also applies to any of the suttas, really. Is there any particular reason why this one?
It actually goes down to hopefully the actual cause.
Okay. So it's a bit more fundamental, okay. Okay, thank you. I'll bear that in mind. We'll just see if we get any other feedback and see if there's any other suggestions before going on. Any other ones that people would like to look at?
We were discussing the sutra that in the groups for. Someone was wondering about the choice of the word fashion. We all agreed that it was a matter of translation, but maybe you could explain what was meant by the word fashioned.
Fashioned is one of these kind of eccentric translation choices, but I mean the root of the word, you can understand where it is, right? The root of the word fashioned is, I believe, from Latin. Anyone got any Latin? Fasare or something like that? No? No, okay. Anyway, I believe so. So the idea is that it's something which is created, which is made up and so on. Probably the root of it is Sankara or Abhisankara. That particular sutta, the...
The greed, hatred and delusion.
The 34, is it? Cause... You can remember the number of the sutta? That's the important thing. If you get the number of the sutta, you can find any... 3134. Oh, there you go. Sorry, yes, you're right. Okay, 3.34. Okay, very good. So now we know what that is.
All of them, actually.
Yeah. Okay, so this is now using the awesomeness of Sutta Central. So just so that you know what I'm doing here. Here we are on the sutta in English. I open up sidebar under languages, navigation. Again, I can go to any of the different translations and read it in Chinese or Indonesian or whatever. But here we are also reading it in Pali. So the paragraph that we're at here, any karma fashioned through greed. Okay. Lobha pakatang. Okay. Is the term. Greed is lobha. The word here, pakatang, the root is katang, is done or made. Pa is an intensifier. Okay? So it basically means made through greed or created through greed, something like that.
Would it be accurate to use the word intensified as well? Or is that...
Not really, no. But katang means to make something, not just intensify it, yeah. Yeah, it's a somewhat unusual term, actually. Lobha pakatang. Okay. Yep. Go on. Just go on. Go on. So which sutta? That's the one we're on now, yeah? Yep. Causes, 3.34?
Yeah.
Yep. So that's the one we discussed before lunch.
The one I mentioned was actually before 3.69.
Right, that's right. That was the one we had on the list to read. Yeah, but 3.34 is the one that we discussed before lunch.
The one
they... Yeah, in the discussion group.
Yeah.
Okay. Still asking for any other suggestions before we go on.
The one where the...
Mei An, sorry. Be with you in a minute, Simon. Mei An.
There's a lot of descriptions about heaven and hell.
Okay.
I was just wondering whether there's anything like that you can describe
it a bit more. Okay, so heaven and hell. So that would be like the, I think, the Bala Pandita Sutta we had on the reading list. Okay, let me just check. Double check what's there. No, how did I do that? Let's keep on closing this by mistake. Okay. I think we had... Let's make sure that we actually use the same sutta that we have on the list. Yeah, we had the Bala Pandita, MN 129. Okay. Okay. Good. Okay. Any other suggestions? Simon.
Pala, FN 3621,
eight causes of
feeling of which
karma is
identified.
Okay. So SN 36.1.
36.21.
So 36.21. And 36.21. Bingo. Page not found. 36.21 is not a valid sutta. Oh, SN, sorry. Thank you. Except my computer's not working. That's very bad. There you go. 36.21. There you go. Next. Mayan again. Okay, so we've probably got enough to be going on with. Okay, Sankarupati. Okay. Any other suggestions? We've got enough to be started with anyway. Right, let's go. So the first one was, no one picked my favourite. No, it's all right, don't worry about me. We'll just do the suttas that you want, okay? This is what it's about. Okay, so first one was the 3.8 Anguttara Nikaya 3.69. So just by the way, while we're doing this and discussing it, it's a good idea just to sort of bear in mind how we're referring to these things and so on, because it is actually very useful to be able to, just to be able to find what you want, to share it and discuss it and so on. So the easiest, the most convenient way of talking about the suttas is just in terms of the reference number. So AN 3.69, and then if you know that on Sutta Central, you can find it anywhere. Titles are a hassle, because the titles in the Pali editions are often different, right? And then the translated titles are also different. So if you refer to a sutta by a title, it's a bit uncertain exactly what it is, but if you use the ID, you can find it much more easily. So that's just a bit of practical advice for looking up the suttas. Okay, so here we go. He's free. So this particular translation, it's important to bear in mind, this one is by Tanisaro, rather than Bhikkhu Bodhi, which most of the other ones were. So, three roots of the unskillful. What three? Greed is a root of the unskillful. Aversion is a root of the unskillful. Delusion is a root of the unskillful. Greed itself is unskillful. Now, that's an interesting translation choice, but I'll just come here. I have the Pali text. So Tanisaro has translated, greed itself is unskillful. The actual literal Pali text says, what is greed, that is a root of the unskillful. Okay, so whatever is greed, that is a root of the unskillful. That's a different. So he's chosen a kind of an idiomatic translation here to say greed itself is unskillful. Whatever a greedy person fabricates by means of body, speech or intellect, right? Body, speech or mind is a more normal translation here. Body, speech or mind, that too is unskillful. Whatever suffering a greedy person, his mind overcome with greed, his mind consumed, wrongly inflicts on another person through beating or imprisonment or confiscation or placing blame or banishment with the thought, I have power, I want power, that too is unskillful. Thus it is that many evil, unskillful qualities/events, presumably dhammas, aneke papaka akusala dhamma, many unskillful, bad, unskillful qualities, conditioned by greed, come into play. Don't like that translation, come into play. It means are created, right, or come to be. So what's it? Oh, I want power. Balavam hi balato. Okay. So here. This is pointing to the kind of escalation of the unskillful. Right. It's starting with the roots. Right. Greed, hatred, and delusion, and then how that actually manifests and comes out. I mean, the basic point here is that actually we all have greed, hatred and delusion, right? Unless you're an arahant, okay? So please, arahants in the audience, don't be offended, I'm excluding you. For those of us who are not arahants, we have greed, hatred and delusion. So that's just how it is. Deal with it, okay? But we don't have to act out of those things. Because we also have non-greed, non-hatred, non-delusion. Non-greed being generosity, letting go. Yeah. Non-hatred, loving-kindness and compassion. Non-delusion, we have wisdom, intelligence, and so on. So we have those things. So we don't. The fact that we have greed, hatred, and delusion, that doesn't determine our choices. It influences our choices. It doesn't fix them. Okay? So the greed itself is unskillful. That will be cause of suffering. Then the next thing is the karma, which is made from that, right? So whatever a greedy person fabricates by means of body, speech, and mind, fabricates is a poor translation, but it basically means any karma that you make. So whatever you abhisankaroti is the Pali term here. Abhisankaroti. It means whatever you create, whatever you do by means of body, speech, or mind, that too is unskillful. Okay? So the root is unskillful. The action which is motivated by that root is unskillful. Right? So whatever suffering a greedy person wrongly inflicts on another person, okay? So this is then going to that then next stage, is because what happens is that when we have those defilements, greed, hatred, and delusion, we suffer because of it, we're confused because of it, and so on, and we tend to externalize, right? So we blame others, right? So you see this happening in the workplace all the time, people, you know, gossiping and criticizing and externalizing the blame because of your own greed, right? So this is multiplying the problem. We do it on an individual level, we do it in a family or a home. We do it on a social level in society, right? We blame the other, we put people in concentration camps and call them, you know, illegals. And we put people, you know, we go to war in other countries and all of these kinds of things. And we do these unwholesome, unskillful actions because we're not able to accept responsibility for our own choices. So this is like a kind of an unfolding, right? How these kind of unwholesome things, they start, there's like a kernel of it there, and they come out and they spin out from something which initially seems to be kind of innocuous, right? And then becomes this very powerful and very destructive force. So the good news, of course, is that you don't have to do that, that you can reverse the cycle. So somebody like this, so somebody who acts on result as caused by greed, hatred, and delusion, is called someone who speaks at the wrong time, unfactual, what is irrelevant, speaks contrary to the Dhamma and contrary to the Vinaya. In other words, that they go against, they do the negative part of the speech aspect of the dasa kusala kama pata, which we looked at earlier, right? So you can see all these teachings are interconnected, right? In the suttas we talked before about the 10 pathways of right and wrong action, and here again that's coming in here. So that's somebody, and then as a result of that, when all of those things happen, then you're told what you deny what's true, the truth. When you're told what's unfactual, he doesn't make an effort to untangle it to see this is unfactual, this is baseless. Right? So this is giving some more details about how this kind of wrong speech works, and this of course is very true, isn't it, right? When you act because of greed, hatred, and delusion, you create all of these problems and all of this suffering, and when you're called to account for that suffering, you then deny it. It wasn't me, it was them, right? Yeah, and so you externalize it and it gets further and further and further. And that person dwells in suffering right in the here and now, feeling threatened, turbulent and feverish, and the breakup of the body after death can expect a bad destination. Just as a sal tree, a birch or an aspen, when smothered and surrounded by three parasitic vines, falls into misfortune, into disaster. Same way, a person like this, his mind overcome with evil, unskillful qualities, born of greed, hatred and delusion, dwells in suffering here and now, and at the break of the body after death can expect a bad destination. So just something to note about in the translation, this idiom is often translated here and now, the Pali te vedame, but you can see that clearly actually what here and now is really an incorrect translation, even though I think it's pretty universal, because it doesn't actually mean in the immediate present, okay? What it means is in this very life. Okay, so somebody does that bad karma, it doesn't necessarily mean they're suffering in the moment that they make it, that maybe it's tomorrow that they'll suffer, maybe it's next year, right? So it doesn't necessarily mean immediately present, it just means in this life rather than in future lives. So they dwell in suffering in this very life, and at the breakup of the body after death, they can expect a bad destination, the three roots of the unskillful. And of course then the opposite. One of the problems when talking about the suttas is the suttas always start with the unwholesome and then go to the wholesome. So when you're talking about it, you always start out talking about the negative stuff. So sometimes you can skip over it and go to the wholesome stuff. Okay, so lack of greed, aloba, is skillful. When you don't have greed, your acts are then motivated by that lack of greed, and they're good. And then the speech you use and the acts you do, all because of that, are all good, and so on. And someone like that is someone who speaks at the right time, speaks what is factual and what is relevant, in line with the Dhamma and the Vinaya. Just as if there were a sal tree, a birch, or an aspen, smothered and surrounded by three parasitic vines. A man would come along carrying a spade and a basket. He would cut the vines at the root and then would dig around them. Having dug around them, he would pull them out. Even down to the rootlets, he would cut the stalks of the vines. Having cut them, he would slice them into splinters. This is all very familiar to those of us who've lived in forest monasteries in Australia and have to do weeding and trying to keep all the pests out of the bush. He would cut the stalks of the vines. Having cut them, he would slice them into splinters. Having sliced them into splinters, he would pound them into bits. Having pounded them into bits, he would dry them in the wind and sun. Having dried them in the wind and sun, he would burn them in a fire and reduce them to powdered ash. I love this simile, it's fantastic. Having reducing them to powdered ash, he would winnow them before a high wind or let them be washed away in a swift flowing stream. Okay? Now that's how you get rid of it, yeah? Fantastic, isn't it, yeah? How sorry you have to be, yeah? You're making sure there's no thing that's really how it is, isn't it? If you're dealing with weeds or something in the garden, you can pull out the weeds, just one seed you can leave behind, one little bit, and then it can all come back. Yeah? That's the same thing with your spiritual practice. You're really, really, really making sure that these things are gone. Yeah. So made out like a palm stump. They used to actually have a palm stump down below here in the garage. I don't know where it came from, but I assume that they got it at some stage because of this simile, and that somehow somebody gave a palm stump for some reason. But they used to have one down there anyway. Okay, so that's that particular sutta. Any questions about that, or comments, ideas, thoughts? Oh, yeah.
But this is talking about getting rid of desire, right?
Well, it's talking about the consequences of it, but the simile, yeah, it's talking about how you completely annihilate all of those things, yeah.
But something I've seen in some practitioners is like they're trying to be quite hard on themselves and dig these things out, but there's not a lot of joy in them.
Right.
So what I've seen with, I'm just speaking from experience, I'm not speaking in a...
Someone got a tissue?
Easy way.
Sorry.
But I've seen, like, from Mahayana monks, they're not so tight with Vinaya, but they're more joyful.
Right.
So I'm just wondering, like, sometimes people lack joy when they're doing this, so how
can
do
be,
you do it in a very moderate, middle path, kind of balanced way?
Yeah. You know, you've probably heard the story of how Arjun Brahm came to go to Thailand. Did you ever hear that story?
No. Well,
sorry?
He broke up with his girlfriend?
Well, that's assumed, right? I mean, that's a given. No. Did he? No. He was a Buddhist. He was in England, and he was practicing meditation and stuff like that, and he wanted to be a monk. He was interested, so he thought, okay, he'll go around to the different temples in London at the time. There weren't that many, and he'll see where the monks are the happiest. And so he went to the Sri Lankan temple and the Burmese temple, and he went to the Thai temple, and they smiled more, so he thought, okay, I'll go to Thailand. True. Yeah. So, yes, it is possible, if you look in the, where are we now? Okay. And we'll try to stick to the suttas because, well, that's what we're here to do, right? So this is the Dhammacetiya Sutta. Unfortunately, we don't have a translation on Sutta Central. If only we had complete translations of the suttas, which we don't. Okay, so we'll have a look at the Pali of it, which is probably a bit of a waste of time. But anyway, this is King Pasenadi talking to the Buddha. It's a very nice sutta, the Dhammacetiya Sutta, Majjhima Nikaya number 89. And King Pasenadi comes to the Buddha and worships him and pays very kind of elaborate homage to him. And the Buddha says, you know, why is it and why do you feel so emotional? You know, he clearly has a very strong emotional response in the Buddha, and he gives a number of examples of why the Buddha and the Sangha is something which is very inspiring, and why he likes to come and see the Buddha and come to see the Sangha. And one of them, it's a bit hard to find the passage in Pali. Anyway, he says that he basically says that he sees some ascetics in different traditions, and they, you know, when they lead the holy life, they look kind of depressed and stressed out and anxious and so on. And he says he doesn't find that very inspiring. But then when he goes to the Buddhist monasteries and sees the sons of the Sakya and sees the followers of the Buddha practicing, he sees them smiling and he sees them happy and joyful. And then he thinks, oh, well, they must be onto something. And so that's one of the characteristics of the Dhamma. So if you're practicing Dhamma well, then on the whole, it should lead to happiness. I mean, that doesn't mean that you've got to be happy all the time, right? I mean, that's life. But you know, if your practice is leading you to feeling tense and all of those things, then there's something wrong with it. Yeah. So. Yeah, I mean, to me, you know, I know what you mean, and I know that it can very often happen that, you know, monks can get too tight around vinaya and this kind of thing, and I think that is a problem. But my main experience with it hasn't been really like that, you know. I mean, I was in Nanachat, and you know, my teacher there was Ajahn Pasano, and he wasn't like that at all. He was very nice and very kind and, you know, very relaxed. And you know, then I went to Perth and came and we stayed with Ajahn Brahm, and he's always happy. And you know, so my main experience has been with the vinaya that it should be something which helps you to live a life that's easy and relaxed. And if you're getting too, I know that you know, the people get too tense about it, but yeah, to me that's just kind of imbalance. Yeah. Yeah. Oh, yeah. Yes.
Why is it not delusion, greed and hatred?
Well, I think
delusion is after all the root.
It is, yeah.
So actually it's not quite a very correct presentation.
Oh, you think that the Buddha was wrong?
No, not to say the Buddha is wrong.
Are you sure?
No, but that delusion comes first before the other two really come into existence.
Yes, but mm-hmm. Also no. Like independent origination, avidya comes first. So avidya is more fundamental, right? Avidya is this kind of basic darkness, is the unknowing. Yeah. Now delusion, I think, is basically has the same meaning, right? But there's a slight difference in that delusion is more of an active force. Yeah. Delusion is not simply unknowing, but it's a force in your mind which distorts knowing. Yeah, it actively stops you from knowing.
It's an overlay.
Yeah, it twists things. Yeah, so I think in if you look at how the suttas structure things, they usually put the most important things first and last. Mm-hmm. Yeah, so in this case, I think delusion is put last because of that. You know, its significance maybe that when you're practicing, initially the first thing you do is to try to restrain your greed and hatred. I think these are like a pair. And you try to sort of moderate these, and then over time, because these are like, greed and hatred are more like the emotional contortions.
Yeah.
right?
More
easily recognizable anyway, yeah. And so when they're a bit calmer, the mind's a bit clearer, then you're able to see delusion. So I think it's more practical, yeah. But in terms of the ultimate roots, then yes, it's avidya is the ignorance is the ultimate root, yeah.
Well, on Wednesday, was it Ajahn
Sun?
He said his meditation metaphor was the retreat.
Okay, sorry, Ken, just to say, the word is done.
Sorry.
Everyone says to me all of these different words, Dawn, all those things. His name is pronounced Dunn. In fact, technically, Dunn.
Yes.
Right. Anyway, just FYI, go on.
So his nemesis was a tree with seven branches representing the days.
Okay.
In meditation practice, he'd cut off the delusion, the anger, the greed on Monday. And then he moved on to Tuesday. By the time he went to Tuesday, Monday was grown again.
Okay.
And he said then, so then he said he needed to get to the roots.
Yeah.
And his roots were the mind's attachment. So he disassociated the mind's attachment to thoughts, but his roots were the mind's attachment to body, in his metaphor.
Okay.
Which is interesting to me, because when I only went to what Buddha Dharma once, and they asked me to take up, to help in the garden, and they asked me to take up a tree trunk.
Uh-huh.
And I was digging, and I felt identified with that. So I've been asking the question, what is my taproot for the last month? And
okay.
I gave the answer.
Okay.
And now this is saying that the roots of the three, you know, so to what extent is that also a manifestation? I could see that being, the attachment to body could underlying all of sensuality. I could see that being the real taproot of all sensual experience and underlying some of the delusion and anger and greed.
Yeah, but it's not the most fundamental. I mean, you can be not attached to your body and still be bound in samsara.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah?
Yeah, so that's just an alternative sort of teaching.
Yeah. Yeah. So, I mean, greed, hatred, and delusion can manifest in all different kinds of ways, yeah? So, yeah. Okay. Is that it for that particular sutta? Shall we move on? Yeah, I think maybe we should move on. We'll look at the next sutta we were going to look at was it this one? Okay, so we can look at the one about things that have originated from the past. But before we do that, let's do some meditation for a few minutes. Calm the mind down. Okay, so here we go. We'll look at the Sangita Nikaya 36.21. The Sivaka Sutta with the wanderer, Molya Sivaka. So wanderer doesn't just mean somebody who walks around from place to place, but it refers to somebody who's a member of an ascetic movement, ascetic order, called the Pabajas, Pabajitas, who used to, did they used to wander around the place? I guess they did. Pabajita. Anyway. I'm thinking about translation options. Okay, so he went to see the Buddha, exchanged greetings with him. So notice that it doesn't, we mentioned before, we talked about the different ways that different people approach the Buddha. So he didn't bow to the Buddha and so on. He went up and said, "How's it going, Buddha?" They sat down and they had a chat, right? And that's okay, right? And so sometimes, you know, I'm in situations where as a monk, you know, people kind of enforce these kind of protocols on people, you know. You have to bow before you talk to the monk or something like that. No, you don't. If you want to bow, that's fine. That's a very nice gesture of respect. If you don't feel like bowing, don't bow. That's fine, okay. If you just want to say, g'day, how's it going? This is also fine. It's not my job or anybody else's job to tell you how to behave. But we just do these things as a gesture of respect. And, you know, in Australia, we live in a country where the Prime Minister can refer to one of the leading Buddhist monks in the country by the reverential epithet, g'day, mate, which is actually what happened a couple of years ago, the Australia Day event. Kevin Rudd greeted Ajahn Brahm. G'day, mate. True story. It's okay. Not necessarily the best thing he could have said in the event, but, you know, that's all right. Anyway, moving on. Okay, so there are some ascetic and Brahmins who hold such doctrinal views as this: whatever a person experiences. So notice there are some ascetic and Brahmins, not the Buddha, but some people around the place who have this idea. Whatever a person experiences, whether it be pleasant or painful, or neither pleasant nor painful, all that is caused by what is done in the past. In other words, all that is caused by past karma. Okay? That's the word here. What does Master Gotama say about this? Right? Again, the term of address, Master Gotama being a polite term of address, but not a kind of reverential one, but just sort of an ordinary polite way of talking. And the Buddha replies, some feelings, Sivaka, arise here originating from bile disorders. Again, just to note the use of language here, when the word here is used, it means in this life. Okay? So what that was talking about during life, during the lifetime, this is what we see. Some arise from bile disorders, some arise from and that some feelings arise here originating from bile disorders, one can know for oneself, and that is considered to be true in the world. Okay? So it's both something that you can look inside. So a bile disorder, just so that you understand, this is a kind of Ayurvedic way of thinking about illness, right? And so they have the different humours and so on, which have an imbalance, right? So when you have the bile disorder, I mean, I'm guessing this is kind of like acidic or something like that. So you can kind of actually feel that acidic reaction in your gut or something like that. And then you can see the sickness that arises from that. So not only is something you can know for yourself, it's widely considered to be true in the world. Now, when those ascetic and Brahmins hold such a doctrine of view as this, that everything you experience is caused by what is done in the past, they overshoot what one knows by themselves, and they overshoot what is considered to be true in the world. Therefore, I say that this is wrong on the part of those ascetics and Brahmins. So, sorry, just checking the translation. Yeah, so this is Bhikkhu Bodhi's translation. They overshoot what is considered to be true in the world, okay? Similarly, some feelings arise here originating from phlegm, wind, from the imbalance of the three, imbalance of the humours, produced by change of climate, uttuparinamaja, produced by careless behaviour, visama pariharaja. Not necessarily exactly a precise translation here. The careless behaviour, the actual word is visama, which means something perhaps closer to unaccustomed. Sometimes it's translated, but it basically means doing things that is unsuitable. So it might be careless, but might not be particularly. It might be something like, you know, you I don't know, go for a long run when you're not fit enough for it, and so you get sore muscles or something because of it, something like that. Or it could be just an accident or something caused by assault, caused as a result of karma. Some are produced that the feelings arise here produced as a result of karma. One can know for oneself, okay, and that is considered to be true in the world. When ascetic and Brahmins hold such a doctrine and view that everything is produced by karma, then they overshoot what one knows by themselves, and they overshoot what is considered to be true in the world. Therefore, I say this is wrong on the part of those ascetics and Brahmins. When this was said, the wanderer of Malayasivaka said to the Blessed One, magnificent Master Gotama, magnificent Master Gotama, may Master Gotama remember me as a lay follower who's gone for refuge for life. Of course, this being a stock phrase about going for refuge, just a point to remember arising from text critical studies is that these parts of the suttas, which are the narrative portions of sutta, these are the parts which are usually the most divergent from one text to another, okay? So we frequently find the case that the teaching will be the same, and yet when it comes to the end, somebody might say, please let me go for refuge. Somebody else might say, I want to become a monk. Somebody else might say, yeah, no, I'm not really persuaded. That happens rarely, but it does happen. Somebody else might become enlightened or whatever. So those particular parts of it are perhaps less reliable than the actual teaching parts. And finally, we come to the verse. And again, just to mention from a textual kind of basis, that in this text, we have that kind of a a summary verse at the end. And this is a common feature in the suttas, particularly common in the Anguttara Nikaya. And, you know, often you can see these verses are not particularly attributed to anyone. Okay, they might be kind of loosely attributed to the Buddha or not, but it's a bit hard to say. And I think in many cases the verses could have been added at a later date, but usually their purpose is simply to summarize the teaching before. Again, remembering the idea I mentioned before of making backups. Right. So when you're reading these verses, I just mentioned this because I remember when I was first learning the suttas, I'd often read the verses looking for some kind of new insight into what was said in the suttas, right? You read the sutta and you get to the end and you want to, maybe it says something else, maybe there's another interesting point there. And only very rarely do you find that, okay? And after a while I realized that that's the point. The point is that the verses are not trying to tell you anything new, they're trying to repeat what was already said in another way, yeah, in order to help the memorization process. So that is what is being done here. Bile, phlegm, and also wind, imbalance, and climate too, carelessness and assault with kama result as the eighth. This is just a mnemonic verse so that you can make sure you can remember what all of those eight things are. Right? It doesn't have any other purpose. Okay, so this is, again, one of the places where the Buddha is very explicitly teaching this idea that not everything is caused by karma. There are many other places, including several other contexts in the readings which we gave. And yet, of course, this being one of the most common views that we find in the Buddhist world. Perhaps the most interesting one about this particular thing is that it says that you can actually know for yourself that some feelings are produced by karma. Okay? And what exactly that means is not explained in the suttas, but I mean, for most people, of course, we can't know that anything was produced by karma from a past life. Okay, maybe we can if we can recall our past lives, and so there's some people who can do that or seem to be able to do that. But perhaps what's meant here is that, you know, even things which you do in this life, right? And we've seen one of the other suttas we looked at, that some of the results of karma will manifest in this very life. So sometimes you make your ethical choices and then you get the results from it. Yeah? And so you can actually see that that suffering which you experienced was a result of that choice which you made. So I guess this is what's being meant here. So,
some kind of phobias like excessive fear of spiders or something which cannot be explained.
Uh-huh. Can be, although the problem is it's hard to see that, yeah? But look, I agree. I mean, in some cases, you know, you look at those phobias and things and you can see, well, there might be a reason for it, right? Like I had a phobia of spiders when I was younger because I saw a movie called Tarantula when I was a kid. And that was like about this tarantula which ate this radioactive serum or something and became like as big as a house and went around eating people. And anyway, I was growing up in Perth where the spiders are like really scary and they can actually kill you and stuff. So I had that fairly mild phobia of spiders for a while. But then you can see there's a cause, right? But in some cases you can't really see that there's a cause. So, yeah. Mm-hmm. Why is that?
No, it's one of those things.
It's caused because of your phlegm. Right, but even this is not really meant to be an exhaustive list, right? So this is just some examples, yeah.
Coming now, because I heard people say, oh, this is my bad karma, I'm constantly coming into
that. Yeah, or it could be, you know, the algorithm that's used to determine the way that they change the traffic lights. It's also a possibility. Okay. Yes. Yes, Cindy.
We can feel and be aware of our individual inclinations and tendencies.
Sure. In what way? What do you mean?
All kinds of things. So, for instance, you're the only one in the family that is a vegetarian.
Okay.
You know, that's just a personal example. Hmm.
Oh, okay.
Upbringing, but it's tendencies and inclinations.
Okay. That's okay, so you can see those tendencies, but can you see that that tendency is produced by some karma from a past life?
I suppose you could wonder, where does it come from?
You certainly can wonder, yeah. Yeah, yeah. Sure, sure. And I think that's fair enough, and may well be from past life. But I think the point of this sutra is the Buddha is actually saying that sometimes you can see it, and that's the thing which is interesting about this particular passage. Yeah.
If you want understanding of everything, then where do you go? So the Buddha is explicitly declaring that karma is not everything.
Sure.
He's offering a partial epistemology of experience.
Yep.
So where
do
you get the rest of it?
Where do you get the rest of it?
Yeah, I want to be comforted and feel I understand everything.
Ah, okay, fine. So I'll just quickly explain the rest of existence for you. Okay, here we go.
Could you explicitly address that and say that, you know, experience is messy and confusing?
Well, I think this is the point, right? That's what he's saying here.
That's what he's saying here, is it?
Yeah. Yeah, the point is that the karma is the relevant thing,
yeah.
Right? That's for this purpose, right? Now, if you're an engineer and you want to build a bridge, karma is not important, right? But material strengths and tensions and all of those kinds of things are important. So it depends on your context. So here the context is, how do you get free from suffering?
And it's not even complete in experience.
Sure. Ah, absolutely, yeah. Yep.
So that's all about dealing with some uncertainty and messiness.
Maybe the Buddha did play dice with the universe. Okay, any other questions on this one? Yes, Nilushi. Okay. Yeah.
Isn't it then just completely determined by the conditions? Like, is there any point in a bigger level?
No, I understand your point, yeah.
You know, is there any point doing any good or bad karma because what are the conditions that you have enough of all that you have to, you know, for it to be predetermined?
Yeah, interesting point. But I would say I don't think it's infinite, and this is an interesting question. Okay, so just to sort of think it through a little bit. Now, in the human realm, okay, we can make most powerful karma. Okay, this is always the Buddhist tradition always says, right? Because we can make the most meaningful kinds of choices. The animal realm, sure, you can make choices, but they're much more limited. Same thing in the Deva realm, right? You don't have so much chance to do good and bad, right? I mean, you can't do charity in the Deva realm because, hey, everyone's got everything they want anyway, right? So your opportunities for doing good and bad are much more restricted. So it's in the human realm that we make most of our very powerful karma, right? Now, clearly we make, it seems that we make more karma than we experience the results in one life, okay? So, you know, and we can think of that in terms of, say, like a fruit tree, right? So a mango tree produces many, many mango seeds, right? Enough for many mango trees, not just one. However, there's a number of suttas where it talks about this, and it talks about, for example, that like a past life of the Buddha. I'm thinking of something like Mahasudassana Sutta, and a few other places, or even talking not in terms of the Buddha, but in terms of other beings. And they do some kind of act, and they make merit, or they practice meditation, or something like that. And then they get reborn in some heavenly realm, or Brahma realm, or something like that. And then it says, Ayu Kayava Bunya Kayava, due to the ending of the lifespan, or the ending of their merit, right? The using up, the running out of their merit, and they fall away from that realm, and they come back to another realm. Yeah? So, perhaps what actually happens is that, you know, we make this bunch of karma in this life, and we then get reborn in these other realms where we more or less use up most of that bad or good karma in those realms, and then as that's used up and so on, we drift back and eventually end up in the human realm where we don't have all necessarily all that much unused karma to play out. I mean, there's probably some, but it's not like there's an infinite amount, right? And so then we do more things here, and then that's how the cycle goes. So it's not necessarily that we're accumulating infinite amounts of karma, but we have some. But I don't know if you ever run out completely. What would happen if you ran out? I guess that's what enlightenment is, right? Anyway, so yeah, so if in that context, then given that there's, you know, we have much more limited karma bank, then what we do actually does make a difference. Yeah. Yeah. Does that make sense? Yeah. Yeah. Okay, so, sorry, Aya? You're gonna...
was it King Sasanadi's wife?
Uh-huh. Mallika?
Yeah, she made an offering of, what was it, food to the Buddha?
Mm-hmm.
And that same day she went from being a flower picker's daughter to the queen of...
The queen of Kosala, yeah, yeah.
Yeah, and the Buddha said it was... Wasn't it, didn't he say it was a result of the past karma?
It probably doesn't say... It probably says that in the Jatakas or whatever, but yeah, that's the story, yeah.
I mean, that's a good example.
Yeah, yeah. Mallika was a great. She's one of the great feminist icons in the suttas. Yeah, I mean, she's married. She was a, you know, low caste woman married to this great king who was definitely. I mean, she was the one wearing the pants in that household, and she was the one who brought the king along to the Dhamma and all of these kinds of things. That the sutra I just mentioned before we looked at very briefly that we only had in the Pali. I said where the monks were living happily and so on. That's Pasenadi. So that's Mallika's husband. Yeah, and that's, you know, the depth of the faith that he had. And it was Mallika who led him there, yeah. Very interesting relationship, yeah.
I think it's actually the intentions of offering. Like, I don't know, it's actually the same stories or not. This is a very poor girl in India, was actually very, very hot, and she's actually, knowing that the Buddha was actually going to go to this particular temple, and she's actually wanted to make offering, but because she's actually so poor, she could not make any offering. You know, not any great offering, but then she's actually discovered that she's actually have one little koi, you know, a very insignificant koi that, you know, she actually wanted to make offering. So she's actually, with all the courage she's actually put up to herself, and she's actually went and see the Buddha and offered that koi with all her intention, her good intention, and no actually making up wishes that, you know, I offered you this little koi, may I be the queen, you know, may I have, you know, the world. Just offer because she actually wanted to offer to the Buddha. And then when she's actually, and after that, she's actually feel hungry and tired, and she's actually found a little trees under the hot sun, and she felt sleeping. She was actually sleeping, and then this king, he was actually out with his men, and then he actually saw, you know, like lights in the distance. He said, I want to go there, take me over there. You know, in the distance. So when he actually went up there, he saw this girl who actually had nothing, you know, like particular about her, because she was actually wearing very dirty and everything clothes. And but yet he was actually have a great, you know, love, you know, like fell in love with her straight away. And he actually, the king actually took her back to his palace and wash her and then, you know, make her his queen. Intention.
Okay, there you go. So the result of that, offer a coin, become a queen. Guaranteed.
But sure.
No, the point is that it's the quality of your intention, not necessarily the amount that you're offering or whatever. That's the most important thing. Okay, so 36.21. Any more questions on this particular sutta before we move on? On this particular sutta?
Yep.
Okay, good.
Intention, is it good to specify a particular intention, or can you just, I want to do good in any case? Do you want to sort of spearhead your intention, like you do something good and may I attain Nibbana, or do you just do good for the sake of doing good? Because, you know, you can do good without your
intention
to do good,
yeah.
But you can have also the intention to dedicate it for a particular cause.
Yeah.
And there's sometimes the confusion that whether you can do that or not.
Yeah. What do you think?
I think to some extent you can. It's like you can direct it. It's like you can direct it. I'm not saying now it
kids a mark all the time, but in a way you can direct it in a particular direction.
I think you can. Whether you should or not is another question. Yeah, I mean, I think like some of the suttas you look at, like the Sankarapati Sutta, you know, saying you know you can direct your intention like that.
Mm-hmm.
But my feeling is always that if you look at those contexts, the Buddha's never really saying. I mean, correct me if I'm wrong, but I'm not sure if the Buddha's really saying that you should do this. But it's more like if you want to do it, you can. But yeah, to me, this is a question that comes up a lot. But to me, the best thing is that really the best way of doing things is you do it with understanding, you know? And so it's understanding, oh, this is cause and effect, right? But it's actually nothing to do with me. I'm not worried about it, right? I know that this is a good deed and it will lead to a good result, right? But I'm not doing it because I want to get that good result. I'm doing it because I understand it's a good thing, you know? And so to me that's, you know, to understand cause and effect is important, but not to be too sort of invested in trying to control it too much. Yeah, and because okay, maybe move along to the next sutta. So this is the Bala Pandita Sutta, and there's a number of suttas that talk about the fool and the wise person. So Majjhima Nikaya number 129. This is quite a famous sutta. I should just mention a little bit on the translation here. So this one translated by Sister Upalavanna, who is a nun who's living in Sri Lanka, and she did, she translated pretty much the whole of the four Nikayas very badly, which she basically did it as her own personal project. She was studying and learning Dhamma and just did it for her own personal reference. So she just did these kind of fairly loose translations for her own study, and they were never meant for publication. So when Venerable Metta Vihari asked her about this and asked her if he could, publish her work, you know, she was quite shy about it, didn't really want to make it publicly available because she knew it wasn't done to a professional standard. But because there was no other translation available, then she agreed and they digitized her text and put them online. So for a long time now, probably close to 20 years, her translations, which are available on metta.lk, have been pretty much the only complete translations of the suttas in English, fairly complete, which you can get. And even though they are pretty rough and they're not all that reliable, they are there. And I think that's an amazing work to have done that and to have put that out there. So on Sutta Central, we occasionally have some of her suttas, even though we prefer the ones by Bhikkhu Bodhi and so on when we can. So I just wanted to give that background because I thought it was quite interesting to learn about where those translations came from and how they came to be there. So this one has been, when I put this on there, I sort of lightly edited it a bit to sort of clean it up a bit. It's still basically a Sister Upalavanna's translation. May well have been, yes. I think so. Okay. Yeah, so, you know how it is if you're doing that kind of, making notes and things like that for yourself, and you just do it fairly a bit roughly, and so just so you understand. So, the question was about heavens and hells, wasn't it, right? So this is May An's question, just going back to it. So we might skip over some of it because I won't get to all of it, and we have the descriptions of various tortures. Do you want to go into the tortures? No. You sure?
Yes.
Is that yes, you do want to go into it, or yes, you're sure? They're pretty intense, aren't they, right? Those guys, they didn't mess around. Yeah. And it's interesting, you put that into kind of context and you see how severe the punishments were, and then you look at, in the Sangha and the Vinaya, the way it deals with things, and almost always the punishments in the Sangha involve saying, I'm sorry, I won't do it again. Right? And the most severe kind of punishment is to kick somebody out of the monastery, right? That's basically as hardcore as it gets. And in that kind of context, it's amazing how gentle it is. Okay. So then they... okay, so he's talking about how bad hell is. So this is some of the most vivid, shall we say, vivid imagery that the Buddha gives. And this is a very, it's a very kind of nice image, and I kind of really like this image. When a fool, I just mentioned that the word, the translating fool here is bala in Pali. The word bala is actually etymologically related to the word fool in English. If you're familiar with Grimm's laws, anyone knows Grimm's laws? Studied linguistics? No. What do they teach people at school these days? Grimm's laws, F declines to, B declines to F, and A declines to, anyway, so they're etymologically related. The root of it meaning baby. Yeah, originally is a word for meaning baby, yeah? So the fool. But in Buddhism, it doesn't so much mean a person who's unintelligent, but basically means a person who acts badly, right? So lack of wisdom is not so much about intelligence as about your choices, your moral choices. Here, when a fool is relaxed on a chair, on the bed, or on the cover on the floor, he thinks of his misbehaviors by body, speech, and mind. At such times, they press on him heavily, like the shadow of a huge mountain peak would fall on the earth heavily in the evening. Yeah? Amazing simile, isn't that? Yeah, it's just that kind of oppression, and this, of course, the opposite for someone who does good. Okay, so then we were asked a question about heaven and hell, so hear about how you go to hell. Saying it rightly that hell is completely unwelcome and disagreeable, it is not easy to give a simile for how bad hell is. Okay, so the Buddha says it's not easy to give a simile. Now, the Buddha was pretty good at giving similes, right? And there's so many in the suttas where he gives these, and they're always really good similes, yeah? They're always very precise, very clear and so on. So when the Buddha says it's not easy to do, he really means it. And then, of course, one of the monks pipes up and says, but can you? It might not be easy, but is it possible? He says, okay, it's possible. And so here we go with that simile, which the Buddha says is not easy to do. Here's an evildoer. A robber is taken and shown to the king and is told, right, king, here's a robber, an evildoer, give him the appropriate punishment. And the king would say, whip this person 6,000 times in the morning. He's whipped 6,000 times in the morning. In the midday, the king would ask, how is he? He's still alive. So the king would say, whip this person 6,000 times in the midday. So he did so. In the evening, he said he's still alive. He said, give this person another 6,000 lashes in the evening. So, because would that man whipped 6,000 times, 3 times a day, feel unpleasant and displeased? The monks, being wise and sagacious people, said yes. Even if he was given 60 whips, he would feel unpleasant and displeased. So what to speak of when given 6,000 3 times a day? So the Buddha took a small stone that fitted his fist and addressed the bhikkhus, which is bigger in size, the stone in my fist or the Himalaya mountains? Venerable sir, the stone in your fist cannot be reckoned as a comparison, not even a quarter, not even as a fragment of the great Himalayas in the same manner, because the unpleasantness and displeasure experienced on account of giving 6,000 whips 3 times a day is not even a comparison, not even a quarter, for the unpleasantness and displeasure experienced in hell. Okay? So that's pretty bad, right? Sorry, Weenie, are you going to say? But does this sound like it's saying that your circumstances are pretty bad? Of course, yeah, and that's why he's using that simile to say it's not easy to talk about how painful hell is, right? Even though they were surrounded by those kinds of things and they all knew how bad those punishments were, right? And he's still saying that's like a little pebble compared to the great Himalayas. Yeah? So this is why I think it's important not to Like on the one hand, do we want to say, you know, hell is a is a physical place or something? I mean, we don't want to be too literal about it, right? But on the other hand, you also don't want us to dismiss everything that the Buddha is actually saying, or the text is saying. Whether or not it's the Buddha is another question. But anyway, the text is saying, it's giving us a very clear message that the suffering in hell is a lot worse than anything you can possibly imagine. That's the whole point of this passage. So we don't want to just kind of dismiss that out of hand, okay? Doesn't mean it's true, but let not our first reaction be to try to explain it away, okay? He does. I don't know if there's a seven kinds of hell, but he certainly does talk about different. No, certainly does talk about lots of different kinds of hell. Yeah.
And then there's also, I don't know how accurate this is, but there was this, not video, but sound clip that came out many years ago. I think it was in a mine near Russia. I can't remember. They were digging it.
Yeah.
And they recorded screaming sounds, and they spread all over the world, saying to each other.
No, but I'd be interested to see it. I doubt very much if you can hear the screams, but there are some places I know, and it's probably the same mine where it's like collapsed and it's basically just a pit which is just burning and has been burning for years and no one can put it out. Yeah. I was actually, because we were thinking of one of our plans is to make a map of early Buddhism. So we're going to put all the pilgrimage places and things like that. So I was going to put that mine as being the location of hell. So that was my idea. So when you click on hell, that's where you go to. Sorry, Kate.
I'm just sort of thinking, can somebody make, if someone was a warder of hell, wouldn't that be bad karma? Like, you have to have a lot of anger to whip someone
else. You would, yeah.
Like a lot of hatred.
One would think so, yeah.
Like, is this something that doesn't make sense to me? Like,
well, maybe it's the king's whippers who get reborn as the wardens of hell.
Because, like, it just seems like, how could they be doing this? Like, is this something that they're doing at their free will because this is what happens in hell? Like, it just doesn't make sense.
There's an interesting argument by Avasubandhu. He was a Yogacara philosopher, lived about in the 4th century AD, so about 800 years after the Buddha, and he wrote a book called the Vidingshaka. Anyway, I can't remember exactly the Sanskrit title. Anyway, and he's talking about this question of illusion and reality and so on. And one of the interesting things about his argument is that he argues like this. We know that the wardens in hell are figments of the imagination, in the same too, this world that we experience is something which is projected from the mind. Okay? That's not exactly the argument that he uses. Vasubandhu is very subtle and quite complex, but the point that I'm trying to get across is that he uses as the axiom of his argument the assumption that we know that these things are all just mind created. Okay, he's not trying to argue that as a conclusion, right? He's not trying to persuade people that these wardens of hell are created by the mind. He's assuming that everybody in the audience knows that, and that that's the axiom of his argument. Okay? Why is that?
It's like when a person with paranoid delusion sees everybody and trying to kill them. It's just a projection of their own mind, but to them it's real, their condition. So couldn't everything be like that? Everything being a projection of karma and imputed onto something which is not really, we're not really seeing it the way it is.
Yeah.
It seems possible in some ways, but difficult to conceive of in terms of people having interactions with each other.
I understand, yeah. I mean, there's the intersubjective nature of reality, right? So, I mean, this is a problem with that kind of idealist idea. whether Vasubandhu is an idealist is another matter. But I mean, that's a separate philosophical discussion. But the point I'm just trying to convey is that to say that that experience in hell is metaphorical is not a new suggestion. It's a suggestion which was regarded as so widespread that you can assume, you know, 1500 years ago, he simply assumed that as part of the argument. Yeah, that that's what everyone knew that, right? It's obvious. Okay, so yes, the intersubjective thing is a problem in thinking about idealist philosophies generally speaking, but I'm not necessarily sure how relevant that is in the context of hell, because these guys aren't having lots of conversations, right? I mean, there's not a huge social environment happening there. Hell's a kind of a lonely place, which is probably part of it. Yeah. Is there? Well, this is not talking about interactions. No, that's the whole point, is that the wardens of hell are figments of the imagination. Okay? That's the argument that I'm trying to convey here. Yeah?
But so I mean, it seems to make sense that the idea that that's like a figment of your imagination, it's because it seems so unreal.
That's a separate inference, right? So that was the conclusion of the argument that Vasubandhu was using, right? The axiom of the argument was that we all know these hell wardens are figments of the imagination, right? The inference that he was asking us to draw was that therefore this whole world is nothing but figments of the imagination. So that's a kind of separate issue, yeah? So whether it is or not, I mean, I'm not trying to argue for one position or another. I'm merely trying to say that if you were to think of it in that way, it's certainly not a new way of thinking about it, and it's certainly a very reasonable way of thinking about it. Yeah. Sorry. Where are we? Oh, sorry. Yes, go on. Yes.
I guess my reaction to this particular section, it doesn't resonate as well with me as a motivator to practice or to move along the path, because it's so... For me, it's instilling a kind of fear of if you don't do X, Y will happen to you.
Yep.
And it's so strong and it's so visceral in the way that it's going down that way.
Exactly. It is important to note that... a few things important to know, right? One is that I think most studies of these things actually agree that these things actually don't kind of motivate behavior, right? I mean, if you do, you know, severe punishments in society and you have, you know, punishments like floggings and whippings and these kinds of things, it doesn't actually work to motivate behavior, even like capital punishment and so on. So that's one thing. Second, but also to notice about the sutta, this kind of thing is something which we find very, very rarely in the suttas, okay? Now, it'll mention heaven and hell and these kind of realms fairly frequently. You know, there are good destinations and bad destinations. But in terms of talking about the details of it and going into these things, there's about 3 suttas out of about how many thousands in the sutta, in the whole suttas. Maybe a bit more than 3, maybe 4 or 5, something like that. And also, notice that this is also something which the Buddha was prompted to talk about. Right? He's a bit kind of reluctant, yeah? And so, you know, it's certainly, you know, it's not something that he was kind of banging on about all the time, right? It's something that was referred to occasionally. And you might, you know, you could certainly make an argument that this might be a later sutta. I'm not sure, I haven't looked at it closely enough in the text critical grounds. But, you know, it's you know, definitely it's not the case that you find all through the suttas that the Buddha's kind of banging on about this. Yeah, I mean, I always remember when I was at school and I read James Joyce's The Portrait of the Artist as a Young Man, and he talks about his experience in a Catholic school in Dublin, and you know, they'd go along to school and their religion class would be like the priest telling them about how bad hell was, and they'd go again and again and again and be told, you know, well, that all of those things that they're actually doing in their life, like, you know, kind of lying and masturbating and all of these kinds of things, adolescent boys, right? All of those things are going to tell you to go, make you go to hell. And the entire religion class consisted of nothing but elaborate and detailed kind of descriptions of hell, and the worst one, like the end of it, the worst one I always remember is when you go to hell and you look up and you see all the beings who are saved and you see the power of the saving grace of God, and you know that you've completely blown it, right? And you had the choice, and that it was your fault, and you're forever deprived of all of those things, like forever, ever. And it's your fault, and that's like the worst of all of them. And it goes kind of elaborate details of how you're tortured through all of your senses and all of these kinds of things. So, yeah, what can I say? Perhaps one could seek a slightly gentler and more balanced approach to spiritual life. yeah, and that, you know, that's normally what you find in the suttas, yeah. So.
It's the opening teaching of a lot of Tibetan texts.
Is it? Really? Yeah. And, you find, like in Laos and Thailand and things, in some places, I think in Singapore as well, they have these, like, hell realm. They're like theme parks, exactly, like hell theme parks. Do they have them in Sri Lanka? Is that a Sri Lankan thing?
Some of my favorite images in the whole wide world.
Yeah. Okay.
And they're very arresting.
Mm.
And I love these texts because they're so visceral. They're almost like the equivalent of a slasher film.
They are, yeah.
And it seems to me that the function is storytelling device.
Ah.
Very, very memorable.
Mm.
You know, the fivefold bind. Pierced through your hands and feet and then through the chest. And kept alive for years and years and years. Like, it seems to me this is a way to remember the dangers of unwholesome actions. But I just wanted to say in response to Kate that hell could be surely a personal experience, not just a realm in which these personal experiences happen. Surely one person's hell is another person's heaven.
This is a bit worse than turning off the internet, I think. Yeah.
But you don't know. I mean,
it depends on what, you know, in those days.
And the warders suffer. Like, they're also being punished.
But I mean,
for their karma.
Temporary health, like the killing fields, Auschwitz, being a woman in Afghanistan, you know.
Mental illness.
Yeah,
some kinds of mental ones. Sure, yeah. That's probably the... Yeah. I mean, that's some forms of mental illness are like the worst.
Yeah.
So suffering you can imagine, yeah.
Given that the social and civic punishment at the time would have been quite visceral, as you talked about,
yeah.
How can a text like this, I suppose, compete? Like, if you're saying, you know, there's this hell realm over here, but over here in real life you have this, you know, system of injustice and torture.
Right.
What function would a story like this have, you know, to deter people from unwholesome actions if in this life already they see, you know, such torture and hellish conditions?
Yeah, I don't know. I mean, like I said, I don't think it's very effective as a behavioural control. And, that's why I think that the Buddha didn't really talk about it very much. Yeah.
If you're an illiterate peasant life.
Sure, yeah.
Raping, killaging, and plundering.
Killaging, yeah.
Yeah, killaging.
It's like a summary, yeah.
I need a coffee.
Sorry, Nilushi.
Right.
There's actually like a karma opal card.
How does that work?
You need to top up on your merit today. It sends you an email.
I think it depends. I think it depends. We can go into more detail on that, but I think it depends. Yeah. Yeah. No, I don't think it's necessarily the case. All right, we're close up to 3 o'clock, so our time for finishing this session, but I might just very briefly kind of wrap up this particular sutta, okay? So we have all the hot iron spikes through the two palms and all of those kinds of things, and then they have all this pain, but you don't die until your demerit is finished, right? So they, you know, it's like police brutality. They know how to keep you alive, through all of that kind of thing. And then they throw you into the great hell, divided into two and enclosed with an iron wall, the top closed with an iron lid. I can explain the unpleasantness of hell in various ways, but it's not easy to explain that unpleasantness completely. Actually, the next sutta, Majjhima 130, if you don't have enough of this, then 130 does explain more details about that. So, go for it. So there are beings, then it goes on to talk about different kinds of animals who eat excreta and so on and so forth, crawling things, worms and maggots and things like that. So you can also get reborn in those kind of places. And that's the animal realm. And then it gives a simile of the throwing the plowshare in with a single hole into the ocean. So that's being carried around the oceans, and a blind turtle can come up to the surface after the lapse of 100 years. Okay. So the only after a very long time would that turtle actually put his neck up through the hole in the plowshare. Okay, so that's how long it takes for the fool who's gone to hell to regain humanity. Okay. So in hell, there's no righteous living or good conduct. The beings eat each other. Yeah. Yeah. And then when you get reborn, then it's very easy. You get caught into that cycle, right? Leaving some kind of bad destiny, and with that bad conduct, and then you go to hell again. Okay. So that's the characteristic of the fool. So notice that this is not talking about this is what happens to everyone. It's the story is what's the fool and the wise person, right? So it's talking about what happens to someone who does the worst stuff and somebody who does the best stuff, right? It's not saying this is what happens to everyone. It's saying that's what happens to the fool. Okay? So similarly, the opposite happens with the wise person, that they reflect on their conduct, and then just when they're relaxed on a chair, on the bed, or on a cover on the floor, he thinks of his good conduct by body, speech, and mind. At such times, they press on him heavily, like the shadow of a huge mountain peak would fall on the earth heavily in the evening. So this is the feeling of the joy and the happiness that come from those good deeds and reflecting on your good deeds. So then he says, heaven is very completely welcome and agreeable. It's not easy to give a simile for it, he says, but his monk says, is it possible? And the Buddha then gives the simile of the universal monarch, the Chakravarti, and talks about the 7 treasures of the Chakravarti. And that this is the mythology of the Chakravarti is quite important in Buddhism, and it's a kind of a mythological figure which I believe is ultimately derived from or related to the notion of the horse sacrifice in the Brahmanical texts. It wasn't a sort of a literal historical ideal. There'd been no kind of universal monarch in India up to that time, but it was a kind of an idealized vision of what a king could be. And so then not only he lived happily himself, he had all of these treasures, some of them supernatural, some of them natural, the horse and the elephant and so on, these being the symbols of power in ancient India, and also had the gem treasure, the woman treasure, of course, who was the beautiful queen, who looked after the king. And then the householder treasure, who was the treasurer, And I particularly like this description of the treasurer, the perfect treasurer of the king. They're in the ship in the middle of the Ganges, and the king, to test him, says, "Householder, I need some gold." And the treasurer says, "Go to the bank of the river." And the king replies, "I need the gold right now." So then the treasurer dips into the water with his hands and picks up a pot of gold from the bottom of the river and gives it to the king and says, "Is this enough?" Okay, so that's the perfect treasurer to have. So that indeed is pretty good treasurer, right? Okay, and then the advisor, the minister, is competent and tells the king, "You just relax and have a good time and I'll run the country." So these are the seven treasures and the four powers and so on. I don't need to go into detail. It is very interesting mythology, but we don't need to go into detail right now. And then again, the Buddha gives a similar simile of the small stone as compared to the great Himalaya. So the happiness and joy which the king experiences is as compared to the joy of the entire Himalayas. So this is of somebody who's the wise person who does those good deeds, and then in future lives also does the good deeds as well. So this is the Balapandita Sutra. It's one of the most kind of dramatic representations of that divide between the good and the bad, right? And so we look at this doctrine of karma. The simple principle is you do good, you get good results. You do bad, you get bad results, okay? And this is kind of illustrated in many different ways. And in different suttas, we see that there are different kind of ways of presenting the grey areas, the ambiguities in there, the black and white karma leading to black and white results, and all different kinds of ways of looking at things. And this particular sutta is you know, in ways very kind of vivid, and it's very extreme in many ways. So I think it's important not to overstate the importance of this or the role of it, right? This is one sutta among many hundreds of suttas which talk about karma and its results, and it's illustrating a very kind of extreme scenarios here. So don't think of it as saying that that's how the world is. It's divided into fools and wise people, and some people get all the bad stuff and others get all the good stuff. That's not the case. Most of the time, of course, it's actually mixed, and most of the time in our lives we do some good and some bad, and sometimes we're foolish and sometimes we're wise, and that's the kind of karma that we get. And the very famous passage I always remember from the Mahavamsa, the conclusion of the life of king, and I can never remember his name, he's one of the kings of Sri Lanka, and it's was it Mahasena? Anyway, at the end of his life it says, "And having done much good and much evil, he fared on according to his karma." Yeah? And to me that's a beautiful summary, you know, of what this teaching of karma is about. It's not saying, was he a good king, was he a bad king? Actually, he was a king. Yeah, kings do good stuff and bad stuff. It happens, right? And they've got to make all kinds of choices, and sometimes they do good ones and sometimes they do bad ones. And if you try to say that it was a good king or it was a bad king, you're going to miss out on a whole lot of actually what happened. Now, to me, there's this kind of realism about that. You know, actually, he did lots of good stuff. That's real. It's true. It was good. He also did lots of really bad stuff. And that's also true. And at the end, it's not really up to us to judge his life and say, was he good or was he bad? But we understand that whatever he did, both good and bad, that's his karma. Yeah? And then he'll go on according to that. So, you know, so sometimes it can, you know, it can lead to that sense, to me, of acceptance, understanding. It's just nature. You know, we don't, it's not up to us to worry about it and judge it and compare it too much, but just to understand this is how nature goes. And we can do that, we have that sense of acceptance. Oh, okay, we've made those choices. Some good ones, great. Some bad ones, okay, we've done that, right? That's life. Yeah? We go on, we accept the results of it, that's all. Yeah. Nothing you can do about it. The only thing we can do is to try and do better next time. Okay, so we're over a bit over time now, so let's have a break. And we'll come back in about 20-25 minutes for the next discussion session. Okay, so for the next session, we're going to be doing another discussion session, and I'd like to do this in a similar way to what we did the last discussion session, that we're going to have a particular sutta, and we're going to use that as the framework for the discussion. However, I'd just like to spend a little bit of time, hopefully not too much time, just going through the sutta beforehand, because this is a much larger sutta. So that is one of the most important ones in the canon dealing with the notion of karma. That's the Maha Kama Vibhanga Sutta, Majjhima Nikaya number 136. And, you know, if the suttas like the Balapandita Sutta are perhaps quite black and white in the presentation of karma, yeah, seem quite extreme, then in the Mahakama Vibhanga Sutta, the Buddha is concerned to nuance the discussion, to present the sort of the different sides of things that aren't necessarily so obvious. I won't read the whole sutta, I'll just summarize it, and then we can break up into groups and have a discussion of the sutta and various issues that it raises. So this particular one we're reading from the translation of Venerable Tanisura. Thus have I heard on one occasion the Blessed One was living in Rajagaha at the bamboo grove, squirrel's feeding place. Venerable Samidhi was living in a forest hut. Then the wanderer Potaliputta came to the Venerable Samidhi, exchanged greetings with him, and then said to Samidhi, I've heard this from the monk Gotama's lips. Right? I heard this from the monk Gotama's lips. Just to note in passing that this idiom is the idiom that you use when you learn for a teaching from the person themselves, right? And that's the specific idiom, sammukha me bhagavato sutang sammukha patigahitang. In the presence of the Blessed One, I heard this. In the presence of the Blessed One, I learnt this. As opposed to eva me sutang, thus have I heard, which means I wasn't there, but it's been passed down through the oral tradition. Okay? So thus have I heard is specifically a phrase to mean I didn't hear it myself. I heard of this. Okay? Anyway, moving on. So this is what he heard personally from the Buddha. Bodily karmas are vain, meaning conceited. Bodily karmas are a waste of time, right? Empty. Verbal karmas are meaningless. Only mental karmas are real. Okay? But there is actually that attainment having entered upon which nothing is felt at all. Okay, so this is a kind of a somewhat garbled presentation of the Buddha's teachings as understood by a wanderer of another sect, which he then says to a monk to sort of try to check it out. And the monk responds, don't say that, don't misrepresent the Buddha. The Buddha would never say something. And the wanderer says to him, how long have you been a monk? He says, only 3 years. Right? So he's basically dismisses him on that basis. Anyway, so the neither agreeing nor disagreeing with the words of the Venerable Samidhi. Nice statement there as well, and this being kind of quite typical attitude in the suttas. It's very, like, sometimes to me, these little details are some of the most illuminating and interesting, right? So sometimes you can say, yeah, that's wrong, right? Sometimes you can say, yeah, that's right. Other times, I don't agree nor disagree, but I'm going to go and ask about it, inquire, learn about it. Yeah? And to me, that's a really nice attitude to have. Anyway, so somebody went to Venerable Ananda, told him all about it. Ananda said, okay, let's go to the Buddha. And so it's like you're going up the chain of command, right? So anyway, they go to the Buddha and they said it to the Buddha. And the Buddha said to Ananda, I don't even know that wanderer by sight. How could there have been such a conversation? Okay. So basically, he's never even met the guy. So what's he talking about? So then the Moga Purisa Samudhi, so the Buddha's quite critical of poor old Samudhi here, the misguided man, Moga Purisa. Notice that this distinction that's being made here, this is actually a formal distinction which is explained elsewhere in the suttas. That says there are certain questions to be answered, and the Buddha lists different kinds of questions and different ways of answering them. It's actually very kind of useful and quite a sophisticated way of thinking about things. Some questions can be should be answered after analyzing, okay? But other questions should be answered quite directly. Right? So this particular question, because Potali's question was confused, there was actually something, it had some connection with what the Buddha taught, right? It wasn't completely wrong in everything, but it still wasn't completely right. So he needed to analyze it and look what's right and what's wrong. And he didn't do that. So then when this was said, the Venerable Udayan said to the Buddha, "But Venerable Sir, supposing when the Venerable Samadhi spoke, he was referring to this, namely, whatever is felt is suffering." So here Udayan is quoting a saying of the Buddha and suggesting that perhaps this was how the mistake arose. And the Buddha said to Ananda, "See how this misguided man Udayan interferes. I knew that he was going to say that." So the Buddha's, I think, starting to get pretty annoyed at how these people can't understand the basic parts of the Buddha's teachings. It seems like a bit of a kind of a, you know, a bit of a swift overreaction to that, doesn't it, right? I mean, he made this suggestion. It wasn't such a crazy suggestion. But you have to know kind of Udayan was kind of, there's a number of Udayans, but they're kind of renowned for being kind of idiots, right? So Lalu Dayan was kind of notorious for being the most stupid monk in the whole Sangha, right? One of the stories about poor old Lalu Dayan was when the monks were invited to do funeral chanting, and they went to do this chanting for this funeral, and this family had had their young son had died in tragic circumstances, and they come back and the Buddha says, "Well, how did the funeral ceremony go?" And the monks say, "It was terrible." And they said, "Why?" And he said, "Well, because Udayan started he did the chant that began with, 'Oh, wonderful day, oh, blessed day, may every day be like today.'"
Udayan
doesn't really mean all that much. It's Ud meaning up and Aya from the root to go, upgoing, but it's just a name, yeah. So, yeah, so poor old Udayan wasn't the smartest monk in the Sangha. Anyway, so it's quite possible how the Buddha's, you know, being pestered by him or annoyed by him the whole day, and is starting to lose his patience with poor old Udayan. I don't know if the Buddha was losing his patience, but I probably would be. Anyway. Okay. So the Buddha then says, "Begin with, it was the three kinds of feeling that were asked about by the wanderer Potaliputta. If when this misguided man somebody was asked, he answered, 'By doing an intentional karma by way of body, speech and mind, it's to be felt by pleasure, which is to be felt as pleasure, he feels pleasure. After doing karma by way of body, speech and mind, whose result is to be felt as pain, he feels pain. And after doing a karma by way of body, speech and mind, whose result is to be felt as neither pain nor pleasure, he feels neither pain nor pleasure. By answering them thus, he would have given the right answer." Okay, so then he goes on to talk about the great exposition of karma. And I'll just summarize the next teaching very briefly. It's framed in terms of the dasa kusala karma pata, the 10 paths of wholesome action, 10 paths of unwholesome action, which we addressed in the first sutta. And as I said, very important teaching throughout the suttas, keeps recurring many, many, many times. So it's a very nice one to get to know and get familiar with. So somebody, one person does all the bad things, kill living beings and so on and so forth. Then he, after death, he goes to a bad destiny. Somebody else kills living beings and does all those bad stuff. And then after death, he goes to the good destination. Right? One person abstains from killing living beings, from taking what is not given, does all the good things, and yet after death he goes to heaven, but somebody else does that same, does all the good things, but they go to a bad destination. Okay? So here, the Buddha is giving this whole kind of paradox, right? It seems like, you know, people doing all these different things, and yet there's no correlation between the cause and effect. And this one is quite important to consider. Our next workshop, we're going to be looking at the evidence for karma and rebirth, right? So far we're talking about what the suttas say. Next workshop we're going to be looking at what does the evidence say, which is of course a different question. And one of the things that we find in the evidence is that there seems to be quite a lot of evidence for the idea of rebirth, right? There's a lot of, I think, quite strong evidence for that, but there's much less evidence for the role of karma in that rebirth, right? And there's many cases actually quite like this, where somebody does a lot of bad stuff and then they still get reborn in quite a good human rebirth, okay? So this is something we'll be looking at in more detail next workshop and considering why this might be the case. But in any case, here the Buddha is giving us a framework, a set of principles that can help us to understand that. So this is that case where those things happen. Then the Buddha says, okay, so here a monk develops samadhi, and then with their samadhi they develop the power of clairvoyance, right? It's translated here as the heavenly eyesight, which is, I think, a poor translation. Bhikkhu Bodhi uses the divine eye, which I also think is a poor translation. Actually, the word is dibba jaku, which literally means clairvoyance, right? The word dibba is an adjective related to the root, ultimately coming from the same root as the word day, okay? So literally meaning clear or bright. So I think dibba jaku literally means bright vision or clear vision rather than meaning heavenly vision. So they see this somebody doing bad deeds and going to a bad destiny, and then says, well, there must be karma because I've seen this, someone doing bad deeds and going to a bad destiny. And then they conclude that this must always be the case. Okay? I've seen this, I saw it with my own eyes, this person did bad, they went to a bad destiny, therefore this is always what happens. Anybody who says anything is an idiot, right? Only this is true, anything else is false. Yeah? Ira satcha bhinivesa. Yeah? The insistence on the view that only this is right, everything else is wrong. Idameva satchang mogamanyang. Okay, so then some other monk, or ascetic or whatever, practices, develops meditation, they see someone doing bad deeds, and then they go to heaven, right? It's the second case the Buddha talked about. He says, well, there's no such thing as bad karma, and that's what I've seen. A third one, of course, then the different monks see those different cases, which the Buddha talked about in the beginning. And each case, what they're seeing is something real, but they come to that conclusion. Now, the Buddha then goes on to analyze these particular situations. In the first case, when a monk or Brahmin says, it seems that there are evil karmas, there is a result of misconduct, I concede that to him. When he says that he's seen those things happen, people doing bad karma and going to a bad destiny, I concede that to him. When it seems that one who does those bad things will always, after they die, go to a bad destiny, I do not concede that to him. Okay? Those who know thus rightly, those who know otherwise are mistaken. I do not concede that. And if you insist that only this is true, everything else is wrong, I do not concede that. Okay, because the Buddha's exposition is different and goes on to say the same thing for each of those four cases. So in other words, you can do good and go to a good place. You can do good and go to a bad place. You can do bad and go to a good place. You can go bad and go to a bad place. And all of those situations actually happen. And we can't insist that it will always be one way and not another way. So the Buddha then goes on to then talk about why that's the case in the final part of the sutta. There is a person who's killed living beings, had wrong view, and then they go to a bad destiny. But perhaps the evil karma producing his suffering was done by him earlier. That means in a previous life. Or it was done by him later, in a subsequent life. Or a wrong view was undertaken and completed by him at the time of death. Okay? And that's why he did bad karma and went to hell. Right? So even in the case of somebody, they do a bad deed and they go to a bad destiny, but you still can't conclude that that bad deed caused that bad destiny, because it might have been some other thing that they did that caused that. Similarly, someone who does bad things and goes to a good destiny, right? It happens. People do bad stuff and good things happen to them, right? It's frustrating, I know, but unless it happens to you, in which case it's good, right? Right? Why? Because they didn't just do that bad thing, they also did good things on other occasions, right? So you're only seeing a partial picture, is what the Buddha's talking about. What you're seeing is real, it's just not complete. And so you're jumping to those inferences much too quickly. And this is something that we see all the time happening in the spiritual realm, especially. People can't jump to all these conclusions, it's amazing. You see just one thing happening and think, oh my goodness, this is how it is, you know? And it might be that what you're seeing is true, but what conclusion can we validly draw from it? So this is what the Buddha is saying. Can we hold questions? We're having discussion group in a minute, so we'll bring up the questions in the discussion group, please. Okay. So there is karma, and the Buddha sums up, there is karma that is incapable of good result and appears incapable of good result. There is karma that is incapable of good result and appears capable of good result. Okay? So it looks like it's not going to give you good result, but it does. and so on and so forth. So this is the different cases, right? So when you do something, it looks like it's going to lead to a certain result, but actually can lead to a different result. So this is that teaching on the Mahakamma Vibhanga Sutta. And so this is one of the things which is reminding us of the complexity of this teaching of karma, okay? And so what I'd like to do is to break up now into the discussion groups, and any questions that we've got about these, then we can bring those up and talk about them in those groups. And, you know, particularly I'd like to think about and to focus on those questions about how it is that, well, how the world seems like, you know, bad people have good things happen to them and good people have bad things happen to them, and how we can deal with that, because this is, to me, this is one of the fundamental struggles we have trying to deal with morality, right? Any moral system faces this problem. We want to believe that the universe reflects our morality, right? That the world, right? Morality isn't just something we want people to do, but actually reflects how the world operates. And so this teaching of karma, in a way, is a way of understanding that. We're dealing with these universal principles. And yet, so many times, these universal principles don't seem to actually work out all that well. All right? So we have to struggle with this. This is the grey areas. This is the nuances. So this is a chance to bring those things up and talk about them and to see how we can cope with that and how we can deal with those things. So we have about an hour or a bit we'll finish a bit, let's say about 10 or quarter to 5 of the discussion. So let's break up into discussion, talk about this. Please go to a different group than the one you were in this morning, okay? Don't sit with your friends all the time. Go meet people that you don't know. And begin the discussion group by everyone introducing themselves. We all want to be friends here. And please also remember that the purpose of having the discussion group is to practice right speech. A very important part of right speech is right listening, okay? So if you notice somebody in your group who hasn't been speaking, then reach out to them. Invite them to speak. Please, we haven't heard from you. Please, what do you think? Huh? And make sure that one person isn't dominating the conversation. Make sure that everybody gets a chance to speak. And when it's your chance to speak, remember all of those things about right speech. To try to speak in a way that's clear, that's reasonably concise, that makes sense, and that actually contributes and elevates the conversation by staying relevant and by saying something meaningful, okay? So this is what we're trying to practice in the next hour. Okay, let's break up. Let's do it. Okay, so we are just near the end of the day's events, and we have 5 minutes left. And in those 5 minutes... Actually, there's one sutta which I wanted to talk about, which I didn't get the chance to talk about, so we're going to do that. Very important, and I didn't talk about it earlier, but it just came up in the group that I was with before. Four kinds of karma. Black karma with black result. White karma with white result. Both black and white karma with both black and white result. Yeah? Very important, yeah? That means that when we're thinking about ethical issues, we always have the tendency to want to reduce it to being to a binary. Is this right or is this wrong? And in Buddhist ethics, we can't always do that. Sometimes it's both right and wrong, and you can't reduce it anymore. Okay? So all you can do is understand what you're doing, and you have to make that choice. And people come to these choices all the time, right? They have a beloved pet, and they think, should we, you know, the pet is sick, do we put our pet dog down, right? It's black and white karma. You want to relieve it from suffering, but you're also taking a life. You can't reduce it and say at the end of the day it's either one or the other. It's both. And so we have to make these choices sometimes, and the important thing is that we understand that this is the case and that we accept the results of that. That's all we can do. And finally, there is the neither black nor white karma with neither black nor white result, which is the karma that leads to the ending of karma. And of course, underlying this whole teaching of karma is not just about you need to learn to do good and avoid doing bad, but that as long as you keep on staying in this samsara, you are going to suffer and you're going to cause suffering for others. So the only final solution is to make an ending of all karma, which of course we do by practicing the Eightfold Path. So the karma that we make through practicing the Eightfold Path is the karma which ultimately leads to the ending of all karma. So that teaching is so important. I thought I needed to mention it, even if only briefly, right here at the end. So we have looked at a number of the important suttas dealing with karma. We've looked at the dasakusa of karmapata, the 10 ways of wholesome and unwholesome action. And we've looked at the 3 roots of what those wholesome and unwholesome action are, the greed, hatred, and delusion, non-greed, non-hatred, non-delusion. And we've looked at how those roots spin out and create bad acts. And we've looked at the relationship between the mental acts and the physical acts. And we've also looked at various sort of qualifying and exception cases and nuances and subtleties where things don't always play out the way that we expect it to. One of the things that we have to remember when dealing with ethics and moral problems is that we can't expect our moral concepts to give us easy and simple answers to everything. Okay? We can't, it's not karma's fault, okay, that the world is complicated, right? So, yes, of course, we can bring up cases and say it's not clear how karma works in here. It's not clear how cause and effect works in that case. This is very true. But that's always going to be the case. Whatever concepts we use, whatever language we use, it's always going to be messy because that's how the world is, right? And so this is why, you know, the teaching on karma and rebirth, it gives us a framework with simple principles that make sense. And we can verify those principles for ourselves many times. And so the fact that there are grey areas and ambiguities and problems shouldn't confuse us from, or shouldn't hide from us the fact that the basic idea is quite sensible and quite straightforward, okay? So just remind yourself, if you get caught up in these doubts and worries about it, just remember that there are many cases when the teachings of karma are clear and straightforward. There will always be grey areas and always be uncertainties. So that's all for this workshop on karma and rebirth. For the next workshop, we're going to be looking at the evidence, right? What are stories, what are research and so on into karma and rebirth. So that will be a very interesting one, and I look forward to sharing that with you next month.